This is Noisy People. I'm Tim Perkis. Today my guest is eco-minimalist composer and violinist, Wendy Reed. There's a point in the life of most artists when they reach what might be called their mature phase, when outside influence becomes less important to them than the internal dynamic unfolding in their own work. Today's guest, Wendy Reed, in some ways seems to be one who reached that point very young. In her youth, she underwent a serious and extensive academic education in composition, including some years in Paris studying with the legendary Nadia Boulanger, teacher of countless other distinguished composers, from Aaron Copland to Elliot Carter, Quincy Jones to Philip Glass. And Wendy immersed herself also in computer and electronic music at Stanford, and thoroughly absorbed in her studies the innovations of Bartok and Berio, Messiaen and Stockhausen. But as soon as her student period ended, she embarked on a series of chamber compositions she calls tree pieces. Now, after some 30 years, standing at number 56 and counting, which all follow what appears to be a severely restricted, similar plan based on a unique notation and structural metaphor of trees, branches, and cell growth. In fact, what she has developed is a rich and focused musical language, which offers her freedom in building a world of quiet and naturalistic soundscapes of great variety. And along the way, she's developed unprecedentedly deep collaborations with the other, perhaps greater musical beings on our planet, the birds, living and working musically with birds, not as trained novelties or as generators of snippets to be copied, but as full improvisational co-collaborators. I spoke with her in her apartment and studio in Berkeley, where she teaches violin and lives with her daughter, her parrot Lulu, and parrotlet Shushu. Hi, Wendy.
Hi.
Thank you for talking with me today. This series that's really extensive. I mean, when did you start? What was your first tree piece?
The first tree piece, 1980.
Yeah. What does it take to be a tree piece?
Well, basically, tree pieces, they're musical processes. They are based on nature. All of them are in the shapes of trees.
So how is, in what sense is this piece shaped like a tree?
Actually, there's like a trunk that is musical motives that go up. And at certain points, the performer can branch off and do another set of musical motives, come back to it, and go off to another branch.
Oh, I see.
It keeps on going to the top. But the basic structure is the trunk.
I see. So the performer has a certain leeway to decide to take these branches or not? Is that a constant
through it? It's basically a combination of spatial notation, but there's a bit of improvisation involved in what you choose.
You choose your kind of path.
Yeah, you choose a path, whatever you like to do.
Yeah.
And even the paths aren't necessarily that different. So there's even a timbral connection between all the, it's just like a tree. You know, there's timbral connections between all the branches, but yet they're different. And in some of the tree pieces, I allow for more freedom than others. In some tree pieces, I've basically said, just follow the written notes. And then in others, you can play the notes. And then within, sometimes I have time frames. And within the time frame, if you're finished playing the notes, then you can go and use those notes in a certain pattern or in any pattern you want to, as long as you stay within the pitch structure of the piece.
I see.
Uh-huh. Or the pitch set, I should say.
So is it, when you say spatial notation, is there kind of this notion that the way things are arranged represents sort of timing? I mean, if you're kind of out on a longer branch, there's kind of a longer time delay when you get there?
And then also I will, as far as the timing, sometimes I'll even have an indicated time and there's a stopwatch involved.
Mm.
So
these aren't all solo pieces. There's ensemble.
They're ensemble pieces.
Yeah.
And sometimes it will be like for two or more players. So it could even be for an orchestra, which I've never ever sent to an orchestra, thinking most orchestras don't want to deal with it. But
well, so the pieces I've heard, I mean, I haven't heard all of these pieces at all, but there's a very strong feeling like you're hearing something that is like you're creating this kind of natural sound environment. It has a very strong feeling of not traditional musical timing of these events, but sort of a more kind of natural, stochastic kind of timing of things.
Yes, definitely. That's why I use spatial notation. And it's all about cells growing. It's like they're all like cell-like units, and somehow they expand. So it's supposed to have that feeling of growth. I've had three piece number 17, which I wrote for Don Buchla.
So he was playing an electronic instrument, one of his electronic, he's a maker of electronic instruments.
Yes, yeah. First he just played with a percussionist. With a percussion and electronics, it becomes very ambiguous of who's playing what and when.
Oh, right. He's making kind of percussive sounds with the electronics.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it turned out that way, too. You could never tell which was which.
Here is tree piece number 17, Nothing is More Real Than Nothing, with Don Buchla on his electronic instrument Thunder and William Winant percussion, based on a text by Samuel Beckett. It's hard to imagine a music harder to represent in 2-minute excerpts than Wendy's. What often sounds like static sound fields are actually undergoing very slow development. So I'm playing here a sped-up version of this 16-minute piece so we can hear its slow and continuous cell growth. There's a very distinct framework for your pieces. I mean, you know, that you have this one form that most of the work you've done over the last 25 years or 30 years has been in this context. And I'm curious how you arrived at that, you know, how you came from your studies. Mm-hmm. I see that you studied with Nadia Boulanger and studied, lived in Paris for a while. And you had also studied computer music and electronic music. And that somehow that all... What came out of that is this particular eco-minimal sort of framework.
Right.
How did you get there?
When I studied at USC, that was basically the first formal study I had. I was always doing lessons, like write in this style, write in that style. And then when I did write for myself, I kind of just copied what I was taught. I just did it in regular notation. And then even with Boulanger, I was doing a lot of counterpoint and harmony and very rigid type of work. And so I never really felt like I could break loose. And I have to say that I was really relieved when I got to Mills, because I felt like I didn't have the same kind of freedom at USC that I had at Mills.
Yeah.
So, and that I felt like when I finally arrived there that I was going to write the kind of music that I was meant to write. The composers that I've been influenced by are composers who I feel like maybe I've stolen something from. You know, Berio, how he twists little motives around in all his pieces. And I play the Berio duos all the time when I teach violin. Mm. And Bartok, same way. You know, there's little motives that are twisted and turned around, even though Bartok is more into folk, you know, you see the folk tunes, so it's not quite as abstract as Berio. And I guess the very first thing I wrote were the clay pieces, which were based on Paul Klee and some sketches and paintings of his, and also his writings.
So do you explicitly think of the sounds sort of being like bird sounds? Because a lot of the sounds in a natural environment will be bird sounds that have this character of kind of little melodic fragment. Is that an intentional?
It kind of turns out that way. It's funny, I've lived with birds all my life. I do have bird pieces specifically.
Yeah.
Like Tree Piece 21 is for a bird. It's a recording of a bird and a violin and percussion. And that one was done way before I started working with Lulu.
So I've been, Lulu's your parrot, right?
This one over here, the big one. Yeah.
This is Tree Piece number 21, Bird Music, 1985, with Mary Oliver, violin, and William Wynant, percussion.
Actually, the bird that was recorded was very much like the little bird I have, which is Shushu, the parrotlet. But what you hear, I never take Shushu anywhere. I just let Lulu come with me, just because Lulu's a little more controlling. I should say is controllable.
Uh-huh.
She is controlling, though. It's both.
So I think you told me before about how Lulu is not necessarily reliable, you know, once you get her on stage, that she can kind of have stage fright and might not
oh, yeah.
come through on a certain day.
I think
day.
You noticed that the other time. she's in training mode right now in terms of actually being in the concert and taking off freely.
Really? Training, are you teaching her?
No, I meant basically I'm getting her used to being in a performance and not worrying about what she does. I definitely don't want to train her.
You don't teach her figures or teach her any musical
things. Exactly what I don't want her to do.
But she's living with you in this room where you give lessons.
Oh, yeah. No, she picks up all the music. You know, it's kind of like me. I mean, we're all influenced by our environment. And so she's in a human and a bird environment with her other bird. And then she hears the birds outside. Sometimes they're calling to each other outside.
Uh-huh.
The crows and her are interacting.
Oh, yeah.
So she has just a really mixed bag of environments, so to speak.
Yeah.
If you hear in a lesson, she just goes wild, a violin lesson. Sometimes I'm thinking I'm going to lose a student if she doesn't settle down because she just loves the lesson. She feels a real comfort zone here.
Oh, yeah.
And you'd be surprised what she sounds like. If you hang around long enough, you know, you'd hear her interact with us. If we start, you know, making sometimes I have had Tom Dambly here where,
player.
Yeah. He was, we were rehearsing for that Other Minds concert. And then we were worried because, at the end of the piece, Lulu kept on going, you know, she started really going wild. And I said, what's going to happen? If we can't get her to stop. And he said, well, I guess after a few minutes, we'll just roll her.
Just roll her off, get the hook. You need the hook.
But that's how she was at the rehearsal. You know, the end of the piece came and she started taking off. So so it's an interesting thing because I think as throughout history, there aren't many people nobody that I know of who have treated birds as musicians where you're really interacting with them in a performance situation. Thank you.
This is Tree Piece number 55, Lulu Variations, with Wendy, Lulu, Shushu, and Tom Dambly trumpet, from a 2009 CD on Niente Records.
Bird sounds have always excited me. I've liked Messiaen's music quite a bit, but I felt like he was trying to almost copy the birds.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't really want to do that. I wanted to actually explore the relationship with the bird, which I'm, you know, doing. Yeah. I'm trying to make that bird part of the music, basically as an improviser within the context of a performance. It definitely works in a very quiet situation here when I'm improvising with her. It's tricky to do it in an actual performance when there's a big audience.
Yeah.
So
you're kind of getting to the essence of bird song in a way that's different than just
right.
copying it or
right.
trying to.
In fact, the bird is part me and I'm part the bird, you know, because the bird's been influenced a lot by my violin lessons, music that I play, and birds outside, but it's half human, and I think of myself as half bird, so
uh-huh.
it's kind of exciting in a way, because Lulu just is endless.
So you want to bring out their inherent musicality and not be overlaying some
kind
of human.
One thing I have taught Lulu is her phone number, and that's about the only thing. And that's
her phone number.
Yeah.
Does she do it as tones, or she does numbers?
6-4-4.
Oh.
1-6-8-5. But that's in case she gets out of the
yeah.
house, I thought. Well,
oh, yeah.
just in case.
That's great.
She hasn't learned her the area code yet.
Hopefully she won't wander too far out of the
right,
area
right.
code.
Yeah.
Well, cool. Well, thank you for talking with me. Well,
thank you, by the way,
you,
for having this. This is great.
Oh, yeah.
I really appreciate it.
This has been the Noisy People Podcast, episode number 8. I'd like to thank my guest, Wendy Reed, as well as my audio guru, Philip Perkins, for his help and guidance. This podcast is available for subscription on iTunes and through its website, noisypeople.net, where you can also find images and additional information about the artists and their recordings. The podcast is also available through our partners at creativedisturbance.org, an initiative of Leonardo, the MIT Press, and the University of Texas in Dallas. Noisy People is a project of Artifact Recordings, and this episode, number 8, was produced in June of 2015.
Mm-hmm.